Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this. I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter. That's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered. Could just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Previously on Ridiculous History.
Whee! Kitty!
I'm back. Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. Let's give a big shout out to our super producer, Mr. Max the Tycoon Williams. I am Ben Bullen, joined as always with the man, the myth, the legend, a tycoon in his own right, Mr. Noel Brown. Noel. Noel.
Hello.
We've had a heck of a time with this roller coaster series, right? A lot of
ups and downs. Oh, no. It's okay. We'll allow it. Yeah, no, ups and downs to be sure. I think we've roughly reached approaching modern times, but not quite. We still have a little bit of history to get through.
Oh, yeah. Just like the experience of riding a roller coaster, we're having form follow function, or form and function be interrelated, because our previous episode, part one, was kind of a up the hill, right? And now we are at a titular point. Now we are at an apex of roller coaster history, because you see, with the dawning of the world's first legit roller coaster tycoon, LaMarcus. I love saying his name. LaMarcus Anna Thompson. Yeah. He triggered an arms race amidst the roller coaster manufacturers of the world. I mean, within just a few months after he becomes the roller coaster king of Coney Island, people start moving in on his territory.
That's right. I mean, he held a virtual monopoly on coasters, at least in this country, at Coney Island. But Charles Alcoke, who had built a kind of more of a scenic people mover type situation, slow scenic railroad that connected the ends of the tracks in a continuous loop to make it more of a pleasure cruise.
I like that. A pleasure cruise people mover. A people moving pleasure cruise.
Yes.
So this coaster gets close to the record set by Thompson's Switchback Railway. But Philip Hinkle makes a breakthrough in 1885. His coaster has an elliptical route and a powered hoist that pulls cars back to the top of the first hill. And because of the speed at which it moves, it's a more exciting ride than the relatively slow moving switchback. And at this point, to be clear, no one has beaten that original train powered scenic railway from episode one that ended at like 65 miles an hour.
Right. And when I say we're roughly approaching modern coaster times, what I mean is this technology in a lot of ways is still kind of how things are done.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And like you said, a lot of these are what we would call simple machines with further pieces of technology added on top of them. At this point, all of them, at least all the rides at Coney Island, are leveraging gravity to work. They're just approaching gravity in interesting ways. There's a ride called the Steeplechase by a guy named George C. Tillieu, which is an interesting last name. I wonder what the etymology of that is.
I don't know.
It's spelled like it's spelled like T-I-L-Y-O-U. So it's like until you.
Or to me again. I don't know. This ride actually, you know, Steeplechase being a famous, is it a specific horse race or is it just a style of horse racing? I can't remember if it's like a particular event, but either way, Steeplechase is a horse race scenario. And this one kind of mimicked that with these mechanical horses that descended on kind of a wavy track. And it was very, very popular amongst early coaster heads.
I also like coaster heads. I think a steeplechase, isn't that the one where the horses have to jump over obstacles? Like they run and they run and they jump over different fences or different ditches. So it kind of mimics what you would experience on a roller coaster.
It's an obstacle race in athletics, but it is named after the steeplechase in horse racing, which to your point, Ben, was involved jumping over hurdles and things like that. But a steeplechase in like an Olympic type event involves going through water, jumping over hurdles and all of that kind of stuff.
So this was named for the horse race, the original version of a steeplechase, because of the ups and downs. And there were other things like the Cannon Coaster.
Yes.
The Cannon Coaster is a little bit dystopian already. There is a gap in the rails.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That seems a little bit dangerous.
Well, often the cars made it across the gap.
Yeah, when one would hope that it would work out that way for you. There was also something called the Mystic Screw, which also sounds a little dirty. Is just in the gutter perpetually. And this
the French trick.
It was a, yeah, exactly. This involved a kind of a helix type pattern. And the riders would descend around 75 feet.
Nah. So, pass. So, around this time, our friends at Encyclopedia Britannica note, people start experimenting with something called inversions. These are the loop-de-loops.
Yeah, and whenever you are looking at, you know, guides for roller coasters written by coaster heads, inversions are a big feature that are always, you know, discussed. Like, how many inversions does a ride have?
And what's their height? Mm-hmm. What speed are they at, et cetera?
Exactly. Yeah. And also things like corkscrews that might send you kind of circling. It's not a full inversion. Exactly. It's more of like a sideways kind of like inversion.
I always thought loop-de-loops were so cool because it is – just from a physics standpoint, it's such an interesting experiment, right?
Well, yeah, it's like taking a bucket of water and swinging it upside down over your head. It's not going to come out because of, mother gravity, just holding that stuff in. And early inversions didn't even have lap bars or what do you call them? Like, you know, harnesses.
Right.
You were literally held in place by gravity, which Hopefully. We know is going to work. Unless the coaster fails or something, you know, and then you just plop right out. Gravity does its thing once again.
Yeah, because the one constant force in all of these things, the one thing that never breaks is gravity. So you just have to stay on gravity's good side.
It doesn't care about you. It's going to do what it's going to do.
It's very focused on it. It's like one thing that it's good at.
Mm-hmm.
So these looped track rides, people had tried them in Paris before in the middle of the 1800s, and the rides were similar to the bucket of water example from earlier. The rides are based on a toy for kids that keeps a small ball rolling on a loop track without falling off. However, at least in Paris, people found these inversions uncomfortable and dangerous. And so the idea was scrapped until 1895 when Lena Beecher installs something called the Flip-Flap Railway at Paul Boyton's Sea Lion Park in Coney Island. Their main attraction was sea lions, but they also, of course, had what they called the railway. It was uncomfortable. It was still dangerous, but it had this big 25-foot circular loop that became wildly popular and went viral, as we would say in the parlance of today, and it shut down after only a few years.
And it was so potentially dangerous that a lot of folks would just show up to watch others ride it, which I can relate to, again, with my kind of building back up my courage to ride the coasters. If I go to an amusement park and haven't been in a while, I will sometimes just kind of watch a few of the coasters to kind of build up my moxie, you know, to go for a ride myself.
Yeah, I think people found the slight acceleration of G-forces, gravitational forces, uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah. Well, it kind of is a little bit.
Right. So this is where we get to a guy named Edward Prescott who builds something called the loop-de-loop.
And that is sort of the stand-in parlance for these kind of inversions. You know, people will often call them a loop-the-loop. And that this is also at Coney Island. Had a bit of a gentler slope, a more oval-shaped design, and was much better engineered and constructed than the flippity-flap. I'm sorry, I know it's not flippity-flap, but I like that better.
Oh, sure. Let's treat the phrase flip-flap with the gravity it deserves.
Hey, there you go. There it is. But it'd still be quite a few more decades, 75 years, in fact, before a very fully successful vertical loop was actually created.
Mm-hmm. And because it had a very low seating capacity, the loop itself doesn't succeed long term. It's not around now. But for the fans of coasters, for the roller coaster folk, it is the coolest thing in town or indeed in the world until a new challenger emerges in this arms race for adrenaline. Something called Drop the Dip, later to be called Rough Riders.
Yeah, I think that's a little better, but Rough Riders, it makes me think of DMX. Wasn't he the Rough Rider, the head of the Rough Riders crew?
It makes me think of Roosevelt.
I got to jump in here. Remember when we were doing our Model Trains episode and I talked about the terrible idea of a third track roller coaster? This is it.
This is the one. Yeah.
Third track being a power rail that delivers electricity to the coaster. But also, as we know, if you've ever been in like a subway station, those tracks are way out of reach. They're down, you know, in the pit kind of the, the subway track. But they're very clearly labeled. Do not touch the third rail because you can get a deadly shock.
Exactly. And the issue here is not necessarily the mechanics at play. The issue here is the human operators, because folks operating the Rough Rider would try to deliver the maximum amount of fun, thrill, and adrenaline to their passengers, which meant they pushed it too hard. They pushed the machine too hard. They used full power even when folks were already going down, leveraging the power of gravity. In 1910, one guy operating Rough Riders, he took his train around a bend just way too fast. He was all gas, no brakes. He threw two cars loose from the ride. 16 passengers flew out over the nearby Surf Avenue, and four of them died.
Yeah, and Britannica points out that these kind of upping the ante here in terms of the danger quotient did force some of that oversight that we were desperately lacking. You know, obviously, it takes a real gnarly tragedy like this, you know, for folks to see the need for intervention at this level. And so you started to see things like lap bars, which kept passengers in place, right? Before that, like I was saying, you were just held in place by the forces of gravity and the G-force of the vertical loop. themselves. Train derailments, however, did kind of continue, though they became a lot less common after some of these, you know, safety measures were put in place around 1912, when John Miller, who was the chief engineer for our boy Lamarcus, invented something called the under friction wheel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was sort of a big wig, or as Max wanted to say, a large hairpiece. Mm-hmm. in the roller coaster industry. Yeah, the under friction wheel. Before you get to that, I got to tell you guys, here's the story of how I almost died on the American Scream Machine. It's due to a lap bar.
Oh,
so
boy.
The lap bar in these things works as, you know, if you're seated two by two, the lap bar is supposed to go down sort of like on your crotch area, the bend between your hips and your thighs. And as long as people are relatively the same size, you're going to be all right. I was riding with an adult friend of the family who was, you know, a grown woman, much larger than me as a young Ben Bolin. And the lap bar clanked down on her, but didn't quite reach our young protagonist. And so, thank God, the American Scream Machine did not have loop-de-loops. It just had the old, it's an old creaky wooden thing where the
first
hill.
It's got some serious downhills, though.
It's got some serious downhills. And I was replicating the experience of pre-lap bar people, because I kid you not, guys, there was a clear like 6 inches or so between my body and the lap bar. So I was almost out of the car.
Well, and that's the problem with community lap bars, because right. Again, you're limited by the largest person in the scenario. You know?
I actually have a follow-up on this, because this is how my friend David almost killed me on American Scream Machine, the exact same roller coaster.
Really? Where
my friend David is a daredevil. He, look, you know, I'm afraid of heights. He has no fear of heights whatsoever.
Sure.
And we were teenagers, probably like 15, 16 years old, were at Six Flags. And what he would do is he would always sit up as far as he possibly could and see if people would not notice that he's just like making it so the bar can't go all the way down. It was like a Wednesday afternoon we were there. The person didn't really check. And so then we're rolling out. He stands up completely out of his seat just to show me how bad it is. I'm just like cranking down on the seatbelt we have. Right. But I got the last laugh, because a year later we went to Cedar Point and I made him ride Top Thrill Dragster. And I actually watched that man cry before it went off. He started crying.
You love to see it.
Good
to
be in touch with your emotions, I guess. But yes, so this idea here, and also shout out to everybody who survived a roller coaster where you almost died. And Carol, if you're hearing this, I forgive you. Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah. It was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody, like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
Right.
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one. And that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it. So the Monte Carlo was tough. I had a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man. And funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
John Miller's invention of the under-friction wheel is a massive game changer because it keeps the train bolted down beneath the track with a third set of wheels. So if gravity, if you get on the bad side of gravity, you have an opposing force attaching your car to the rail, kind of like clamping something. So like the previous ones had maybe side friction wheels that were meant to function kind of as insurance device rolling on the inside or the inner edges of the track. But this is just a much better answer. It stops so many accidental derailments. Our guy John Miller is also responsible for other safety innovations like a safety chain lift, which means, okay, I didn't know this, but it makes sense. Back in the day, roller coasters rolling up that first hill that we were talking about, sometimes they didn't make it. They just rolled backwards.
Yeah, that's not good.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, was there any safety measure in place to stop them from just like slamming to a halt at the end when they drop back down?
Hopefully after the first few times.
I would hope.
After the first few. Anyway, there's a weird thing that occurs here because this progress in terms of safety also enables these absolutely madcap roller coaster engineers to get even more extreme with their designs. You know, a side friction wheel had limited velocity and you couldn't plunge at certain inclines, but this under friction wheel allows you to go even faster, even higher and lower. And Miller himself is kind of, this is crazy, it's kind of pushing the envelope of physics when you think about it. The Russian mountain builders would be astounded by this because they would be like, literally in the ice age of roller coasters, that joke is worth it.
It's more than worth it, Ben. And, you know, you really started to see that arms race kind of playing out where people were trying to top, you know, existing coasters so they could be known as the fastest, the scariest, whatever it might be. And Miller actually really pushed the envelope of physics itself with his Jackrabbit attraction at Kennywood Park, which had a significantly precipitous dive into kind of like a almost like a valley. And then his Cyclone in Cleveland, Ohio, which used the cliffs and gorges, natural attractions at the Puritas Springs to create these kind of V-shaped, paths.
Yeah, and this is where we get to the golden age of roller coasters. And once more, credit where it's due, we want to shout out American Experience, WABPBS.org. You can find it. This is a relatively comprehensive history. By the 1920s, says American Experience, the roller coaster, street name the Scream Machine, was making more screams than ever before. The U.S. had like maybe 1,500 separate roller coasters.
Sure.
They're all chasing hyperbole and superlatives. Like one is 138 feet high. The fastest goes 61 miles an hour. And there were more and more complex iterations of the basic principles, tighter curves, steeper drops, spirals, figure eights that would just blow your mind. There was even once upon a time, we talked about this in an episode of Car Stuff, once upon a time in Los Angeles, there was an auto coaster, which was a roller coaster you rode in your car.
Yikes. I don't know about that, guys.
Just no, didn't work out.
Don't really see those too much these days, if at all. I'm going to say not at all, because I've certainly never heard of one outside of this. It was, like you said, Ben, considered the golden age of the roller coaster. Specifically, though, you know, like we have our Ice Age and all of that stuff and our Bronze Age. This was the wooden age.
Yeah. And this is sort of the grandfather of things like the American Scream Machine. These are the ones that are clattery and jittery. They're lurching. They're made pretty much entirely of wood. Perhaps the most famous is the Coney Island Cyclone, which was built in 1927 by Vernon Keaton and Harry Baker. Even notables of the day, like Charles Lindbergh, would get off this ride and say, that is actually scarier to me than flying in an airplane. 85-foot drop, 60 miles an hour. This is the gold standard for most of modern roller coasters.
It truly freaks me out, the idea of something like that being held to, with such force, you know, being exerted on it on the regular, being held together by like nails and boards. I don't understand how they don't just come crashing down.
Yeah.
The Woodies, right, Ben?
Woodies, that's right. Yeah, and the king of the Woodies is a guy named Harry Guy Traver. A guy named Harry Guy Traver. Guy is actually his middle name. In the 1920s, he starts building his own version of cyclones across the nation. And his most famous creation is the cyclone at Canada's Crystal Beach Park. At this point, just a context note, you know, in the early days, they were calling a lot of these rides scenic railways, wherever mm-hmm. they were. Now they're calling them cyclone. Like, it's not necessarily patented. There are Got multiple it. Cyclones or sure. trademarked, I guess.
Yeah. And this particular cyclone, like you said, Ben, at Crystal Beach Park up there in Canada, actually had a staff nurse on hand in case people experience any kind of medical issues as a result of riding the ride. Another one in the same kind of era and style was something called the Aeroplane at a place called Playland Amusement Park in Rye Beach, New York, which was constructed with assistance from Frederick Church. The Aeroplane really relied on this first kind of corkscrew kind of spirally drop that drops so steeply with such force that riders were slammed against the side of the cars. And again, we see that with things like the remaining Woodies, like you know, the Great American Scream Machine in Six Flags, or some of the old style coasters at Coney Island. They are really jarring, and they do kind of tend to give you a little bit of shell shock just from having your head banged around. And I guess this was a feature, not a bug here, where they described it as simulating the experience of being in a plane crash, which doesn't sound particularly fun to me.
True, right? And I wonder whether there are now VR plane crash simulations. I wonder if people do that for fun.
Maybe. I don't doubt that it exists, Ben. And I was just talking to my kid about, again, our trip to Disney World a couple of years ago. One of my favorite rides there was like this gravity simulator of like what it feels like to be in a spaceship launch. Mm-hmm. And it literally, you're just in this pod. And it's, I think, the same technology that's used to train, you know, up and coming astronauts how to kind of deal with G-forces. It really does feel like your whole body is being compressed against the back of your seat, and it's very claustrophobic. And you know, for being a pretty old attraction there at Disney, I found it to be one of the most terrifying of any of the things that we rode.
I also think what we're learning is the older rides are going to inherently be more terrifying, especially if you have knowledge of the history of roller coasters. You might ask yourself, well, hey, guys, that's all good and well, but why aren't any of these older rides around now? Why have so many disappeared? Well, when we think about the timeline, we see the same thing that affected so many other stories of Americana in this era. The Great Depression came. The Great Depression rolled in and disposable income rolled away. Roller coasters were part of this. With the onset of the Depression and World War II right after that, people just didn't have money to spend on roller coasters. They were busy trying to, you know, buy food and water and sleep indoors.
Yeah. What this came up on a recent episode as well. I mean, it always, you know, you never expect the Great Depression, but it does tend to throw a wrench in any kind of leisure time activities, and folks that have really like invested their livelihoods into these types of attractions or these types of businesses, there's gonna be a sort of a slump inherent.
Yeah. So a lot of these things, even the legend God tier ones, get torn down. The Traverse Cyclone at Crystal Beach Park is torn down in 1946. The Coney Island tornado goes defunct. And by the 1960s, as a result of all these difficult times, the U.S. went from having 1,500 roller coasters to more like 200. So it's a heck of a rate of attrition. And it turns out that when we look at the roller coaster today, not just in the United States, but around the world, we have to thank Walt Disney, because he got super into roller coasters, you know?
Yeah, he's very often credited as kind of rescuing the concept of the roller coaster, which, you know, it's credit where credit is due. He absolutely did that. And he also made them more accessible by not leaning so hard into the absolute death-defying kind of thrills of them all, but making them more these sort of like very thoughtfully designed experiences, you know, and themed. Like, for example, the Matterhorn bobsled ride, which it holds up, man. It's super cool and a little bit scary. There's some parts where, you know, you look like you're about to jump off the tracks and then this Yeti swoops in and there's all of this animatronics around it. So it's more than just a coaster. It really is almost like riding a high-speed, like, haunted house attraction or something.
Mm. There's also a huge key innovation that the Disney crew makes. The Matterhorn's tracks are not built of wood. They're built of steel. So the ride's smoother, quieter. It feels less threatening. And this idea of making coasters out of steel brings the industry back to life. It resurrects it. Disneyland's massive success encourages all sorts of people dreaming of the coaster game to open their own theme parks in different regions of the U.S. and the layer of the world. There's Six Flags, which is, you know, everywhere now. It's a franchise. We have one in our fair metropolis of Atlanta. Kings Island near the Natty. Busch Gardens in Tampa Bay, Florida. And then there are more and more, it seems. Even when the economy is not doing so well, a lot of these places survive. Unless 2030 brings us another Great Depression.
So in the 1960s, a company called Arrow, who actually designed the Matterhorn for Disney, they hired a guy named Ron Toomer, who introduced a super successful line of rides that could be recreated, like the Flume ride, for example, which everyone knows is like sort of the log ride where you go down like one single, you know, incline and get splashed.
Nice. Where are you guys at, Nolan Max, on splash rides?
If it's hot, I'm cool with it. If it's like really, really hot, it's a nice little kind of, relief a little bit.
I go to water parks to get wet. My problem with like water rides and like amusement parks a lot of times is like, I know people like, oh, wear sandals. I'm like, I'm walking around all day. I have like comfortable socks on and comfortable shoes on. That stuff doesn't do well when it gets wet. But granted, if it's like 95 degrees outside, okay, that's fine.
I don't go to water parks, and I'm concerned that you do.
Because of all the pee?
It's a lot of pee. No, I don't like water parks, because water parks, you have to climb up those stairs, and
yeah,
being afraid of heights is awful.
Oh,
and it's wet.
Yeah, I feel you, man. Let's start a hot air balloon amusement park.
It's sort of out of the yes. It's sort of out of the skewer. You are really on this hot for these air balloons, Ben. Hey, there is a park that's probably outside of the scope of this particular episode, but it's called Action Park in New Jersey.
Oh, right.
Often referred to as Class Action Park. It is a water park that notoriously contained very poorly designed rides that would just shoot people, or water slides that would just shoot people out into oblivion. To be injured. In various ways. And one of the reasons, apparently, that this was so common was that the designers of the ride did not seem to have sufficient knowledge or training in physics and engineering.
Just shoot them and go with God.
See what happens.
There's the Great American Revolution ride at Six Flags Magic Mountain, which is over in Valencia, California. Mm-hmm. That goes out in 1976, and it redefines the looping coaster game. Now it's just called Revolution, and it had a teardrop loop. The technical term would be a clothoid or clothoid loop. This was designed by a German engineer, Anton Schwarzkopf. And the company that made this roller coaster is still around to this day. They're called Intamin AG. And so the innovations these guys made brought more and more people back to amusement parks. And today, if you go to any modern major amusement park, like anything that's not just a bunch of carnies in a parking lot, you're going to see some kind of looping coaster. And there was another arms race to get the maximum number of loops or inversions in a single ride. I'm thinking of stuff like Dragon Con in Spain, Monte Macaya in Brazil. And there's one quote. This is probably one of my favorite quotes from the research.
Oh, yeah.
John Allen, president of Philadelphia Toboggan, said this: "You don't need a degree in engineering to design roller coasters. You need a degree in psychology." Noel, can you help us unpack that? What does he mean?
Well, that's right, because, I mean, a lot of it is about weaponizing psychology in a way that achieves maximum thrills. We all talked about how oftentimes the scariest part is the anticipation, is that click, click, click up the hill. Toboggan goes on to say, a roller coaster is as theatrically contrived as a Broadway play. These advancements in roller coaster technology and design tech included a lot of very specific engineering touches that really played with things like your expectations, things like parabolic hill shapes, where you couldn't see what was coming around the next bend.
Yeah, there we go. So it's like Alfred Hitchcock said, right? The monster off screen that you can't see is always going to be scarier than the one on screen. So not knowing what's coming next really messes with your expectations in your head. We also know that the wooden coasters, or woodies, which are, you know, technologically speaking, they're not as advanced as steel coasters. They are now benefiting from the power of nostalgia.
Ah, yes. Yeah. A hell of a drug indeed.
Right. And these wooden coasters, the woodies, become instrumental in the rebirth of roller coasters as a cool, fun thing. And now they're starting to be called mega coasters at this point, around like the 1970s.
Right. And you had mega coasters such as Racer, which was a John Allen design that actually contained dual coasters. So I believe these would have been side by side, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of going in tandem, yeah. And then you also had the Beast of 1979 fame, which had the title of longest coaster in the world. Both of these, the Beast and the Racer, were at Kings Island Amusement Park.
Were and are, because I've been to Kings Island a number of times in my life. I've ridden both of these. The Racer's cool. Racer's fun because no matter what, you're just automatically, everyone is just talking massive shit to the other car.
Fun.
They used to run at one part where one was going backwards, one was going forwards. I don't know if they do that all the time now, but the Beast is to this date the best roller coaster I've ever ridden.
Cool.
It's that first sentence, you don't need a degree in engineering, you need a degree in psychology, is like that, because you just walk up and the Beast is at like a part of the park where it's just woods all behind it. So you have no idea what it is. You
what can't it look looks like. Yeah.
You have no idea. And it's so long and it's like a story, basically. You're just writing a story and it's literally like all you can do on that roller coaster is just laugh and joy. It is so amazing. And it's, despite its age, it's still like, especially for a wooden coaster.
Oh, dude.
Really smooth.
A lot of these hold up. Yeah. A lot of these.
If it's not broke, don't fix it. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, like, obviously, they have to spend a lot. Wooden coaster is one of the big drawbacks of wooden coasters. You have to spend a lot of money maintaining
those. Oh, of course. Sure.
Yeah. Like, replacing the tracks. But the Beast is one that's like, I mean, it's been a number of years since I've ridden it, but it's probably the number one roller coaster in my list. I got about three in tier A.
Let's get to that at the end. I'd love to hear what all our favorites are. I've got a top three in my head right now.
Yeah. As we're getting to that, let's hurry up and get to that part. Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this. I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter. That's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah, it was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's and cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody, like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
Right.
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one. And that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it. So the Monte Carlo was tough. I had a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man. And funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Right now, what you need to know, folks, without getting too into weeds, is that the arms race for the superlatives continues. The titles for the fastest, biggest, longest coaster are an issue of hot, intense debate every single year. It's sort of similar to the arms race for skyscrapers. You know what I mean? Everybody's trying to build the tallest building. And honestly, if you're hearing this, congrats on the Burj Dubai, but should we count the antennas at the top as part of the height? Max says no. Max is giving thumbs down.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
Skyscraper episode on the way. We're just going to manifest it. Yeah. So we know this, right? Like the latest crop of coasters, every time they come out, they're trying to find at least some specific thing that they are the best at, the biggest, the fastest, the most loops, you know, the fewest injuries.
Indoor coasters, you know.
Indoor coasters, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You have these, first of all, you have suspended coasters like the XLR8. 1984 at Six Flags Astro World in Houston. You have stand-up coasters, which, well, there's one called the King Cobra, but there is one at Six Flags that's called the Viper, maybe, or something like that. But it's there's a stand-up coaster at the it's the Scorcher. The Georgia Scorcher at Six Flags Over Georgia is a stand-up coaster. And those are really cool. They're those fun because cool. It really feels like you're like flying. You know?
Don't we have the Superman one too?
Where that's they put you inverted horizontal? Where you're prone.
Yeah.
You're like, yeah. I find that one to be difficult because I just get kind of claustrophobic when I'm like locked in that way. And so I found it to be a little stressful.
It's really restraining. Yeah. I like Scorcher, but the problem with stand-up coasters just in general is they don't handle G-forces very well.
Right.
So you either have to turn it back a lot or you get a little rough. And Scorcher is kind of in the middle where it's really fun, but I've ridden other stand-up coasters. I've ridden bigger ones than that. Sure. I'm like, oh my God, this is horrible.
It's a tricky one. You know what I mean? It's kind of like building a three-wheeled vehicle. Right. But there's it's possible. Right. But also, I love the Superman thing just because despite all the restraints you have to wear, it replicates flying.
It does. No, it's cool.
Which I think is cool.
I rode it once and it's also really, really short. I remember it being obscenely short, which is probably for good reason because it is so restraining.
They're like, how long can we do this?
Yeah, I remember the first coaster that really, blew my mind was the Batman ride, Batman the Ride, which I believe debuted at Six Flags Great America in Illinois, but has been a staple of Six Flags Over Georgia, for many, many years. And that's one where I guess it's called an inverted coaster where your legs are kind of dangling. And if I'm not mistaken, somebody got killed on the Batman ride at Six Flags because they tried to get their hat from this sort of cordoned off area. And I believe the one of the cars swooped down and they were decapitated, if I'm not mistaken.
And then someone on a ride called Z-Force in Six Flags broke their neck. You can find on coasterpedia.net a fairly comprehensive list of deadly roller coaster accidents. To be fair to the industry, these are isolated cases.
Very rare.
Very rare. It can sound scary. And part of that, I would argue, is a little bit of black bag psyop stuff in some of the marketers. But to be absolutely transparent, everybody building roller coasters, everybody charging you to ride one, they want you to be as safe as possible. They want you to have an amazing time. That's why there are 120 different roller coaster operations opening across the world by the end of the 20th century. About half of those, 50%, are in the United States because I ask you, despite the Russian and French origin story, what is more American than a roller coaster as a ride? Mm-hmm. Saying I want to feel like I might die for, 2-3 minutes.
Yeah, there is a sort of cheating of death aspect to it that does have a certain appeal. But you're right, despite its origins, it has become a pretty uniquely American thing. Not to say that there aren't cool coasters in other parts of the world. There certainly are.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys want to, as we close out our series on the history of roller coasters, thanks again to our research associate, Max, do you guys want to tell us all a little bit about your favorite coasters? You each said you have a top three.
I do. I think for me, my number three would be Batman, the ride at Six Flags Over Georgia. Why don't we maybe go round robin until we get to our number ones?
Yeah, no, I agree with that one. That one's so much fun. It's also a great one that if you're there on a night where it's slow and there's not many people there, you can just binge that one. They'll let you
ride it a couple times. Yep, they sure will.
That one's great for that. I'm going to go with... At Cedar Point, there's this one called Maverick, and it's a weird roller coaster because it doesn't have chain lift or anything like that. So it's you were just in constant motion the entire time. And it was the first 95 degree drop, which is a weird thing. I remember hearing that. I'm like, that's not that great of a crazy of an idea. And then I wrote it. I'm like, oh, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen because you're going underneath the track that you were just on. But it just whips and turns, and it's just this beautifully scripted written roller coaster.
Very cool. Ben, you got a number three fave?
I don't really have, I don't really have a top list of roller coasters. Again, it's like the ice cream comparison in episode one. You know, like if they're there, I'll go.
Any stand out that you in your memory, whether it be childhood, but I don't almost
like,
dying?
Like to the ice cream thing, I don't wake up and then immediately travel to one. American Scream Machine, just because I conquered death. Yeah, on that exactly. one, which is the inherent appeal of roller coasters. I wouldn't say it's a great coaster by any means, but I fought it and I won. So number three.
Well, okay. And speaking of fighting against great adversity and winning as the underdog, my number two would be the Goliath at Six Flags Over Georgia, which is quite long and very high with incredible scenic views of the surrounding kind of wooded areas in that part of Atlanta and some serious drops. And every time I ride it, I have to get over my fear of heights because it is massively tall. And at night, when they do the Fright Fest or whatever, Fright Night, I guess it's called, at Six Flags, it is a wild one to ride at night when you can see the like full moon up in the sky ahead of you. It's pretty incredible.
So I was actually, I'm changing up my list kind of on the fly right here because I already talked about the Beast and how much I love that one. And I was going to talk about Goliath as my number two. So I'm going to change it for the sake of having more and talk about Goliath's daddy, which is Magnum XL, which is the first ever mega coaster in the world. I think it's the late 80s at Cedar Point. It's very similar to Goliath. It's not the same script and it's nowhere as smooth as Goliath is, but it's like, it was one of the coolest things about Cedar Point, which I gush about if you let me do it for too long, is there's so many records were set at that park. And it was the first 200-foot roller coaster in the world, and you can still ride it to this day. It's just there's just now two other roller coasters taller than it.
Yeah, because again, it's like the skyscraper race. They're also what are they called? Giga roller coasters? A giga coaster?
Giga's 300.
300 to 399 feet. Which is massive. And I think there's what we're talking about too is this nomenclature. There's also the hyper coaster.
Yeah, I think I said mega hyper's 200 to 300.
Right. So we're throwing in the terms here too.
Oh, you can tell Max is a real coaster. He's using terms like script. You know, I mean, come now, you've done your homework, sir.
Magnum XL is a hyper coaster. There are giga coasters, as you mentioned. If I had to choose a second one, you know what? I'm thinking more in terms beyond just orthodox coasters. I really like the bungee rides where they launch you out and you're attached to a rope.
No, thank you.
Swing.
No, thank you.
I don't like the straight drops, but I like the big swings. Those are
terrifying.
Awesome.
Pass. I ran it one time in my life and I will never not regret
that. You came through the fire. I'm proud of you, Max. All right. So then that brings us to what? Number ones?
Just our number ones. Yeah. Max, you want to go first?
Sure, I can go first because, Ben, you were talking about giga coasters. So, of course, I'm going to talk about the first giga coaster ever made, Millennium Force at Cedar Point.
Right.
300-foot. The coolest thing about Millennium Force, well, A, one thing that's really cool about that is it has probably the fastest chain I've ever ridden. Because you're going up 300 feet, and it's just like you go so fast up, and it's like, okay, that's nice. But it has an 80-degree, 300-foot drop. But the coolest thing it does is the first thing, it goes up and then turns. And on the turn, you go, I think, 120. So your feet are above your head on a turn. And you only have a lap bar on. And it's just so smooth and it's so excellent. The problem with Millennium Force is it's like always broken, at least to the best of my knowledge. Like I've been to Cedar Point twice and I was only able to, one of the times it was broken for the entire season.
It's like their McDonald's ice cream.
It really is the McDonald's ice cream. So if you're in Ohio and Millennium Force is running, you should just go to Sandusky.
All right. Chief advice. And with that, Mr. Brown, your number one coaster.
Number one coaster for me was at Universal Studios Orlando, and it is the Incredible Hulk roller coaster. And it is because I'd never experienced anything like this where it does this thing where you enter on the uphill part, the very first little, you know, chain lift part, and it click, 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 click. You go to this tunnel that's sort of surrounding you with like gamma ray kind of lights, one would presume. And you go click, click, click about halfway, and then it just shoots you out. And you don't know exactly when it's going to happen. And it's like, I don't know how it's propelled or what the technology is behind it, but something about the like the momentary, you know, familiar thing of the chain lift click, and then the nope, screw this, bam, and you're out. There's something about it that just really games your brain in a really interesting way, and you just feel like unstoppable. And it has some incredible inversions, and it's just really, really fast and really, really fun. And I loved it. I've only ridden it once, and I thought it was next level.
Nice, nice. With that, we'll end with a number one, Amayan, that is not a declaration. It's a question. Ridiculous historians, could you help me find a number one roller coaster? What is your favorite? Let us know at Ridiculous Historians over on our Facebook page. Yeah, we would want to hear about your adventures, folks. And can't wait to return with even more strange, ridiculous history. This has been such a, not even an intentional pun, but I'll keep it if we're okay with it. It's been such a fun ride.
A real ride. A real journjourney of self-discovery and then joie de vivre. No, it's good stuff, man.
Without a line.
No line required for Ridiculous History. We're right there for you. Huge thanks to Max for the incredible research work on this one, as well as AJ Bahamas and Jonathan Strickland, the puzzler and quizster, respectively.
Huge fan of lines, that guy. Big, big thanks to Krista Rossiotis, Eves Jeffcoat and Ben Thompson, both of whom will be appearing soon in the near future. Spoilers. Big, big thanks again to Alex Williams, who composed this slap and bop and audio roller coaster all its own.
Indeed.
And Noel, thanks to you.
To you as well, Ben. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.
This is Raquel Willis from Queer Chronicles. Right now, there are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ+ bills in state legislatures across the country. Lambda Legal is leading the charge against these hateful bills that target mostly trans and non-binary people. You can fight discrimination and help write the next chapter of Lambda Legal history. To learn more about their open cases and to donate, visit lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency, where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.